Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Todd, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our first look at the first case of 2026. Happy New Year to all of you out there listening. This week, we're going to be taking a look at the Order. Before we get going, as always, at the normal show notes, if you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe to the show, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early and ad-free shows, just as my first two Patreon subscribers, Channel and Anthony, did, as well as the largest Patreon subscribers monthly, Debbie, Betty, John, and Kenny. Alright, now that all of that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt! So for the first case of the new year, we are going to go back to ground that we have tread on before in terms of the topic. Specifically, we're going to be looking at another hate group active in the United States with tentacles that stretched into other much larger and more well-known groups. Specifically, we're going to be taking a look at the Order, which is known to have committed at least one murder, multiple bank robberies, and various other crimes. Now, the Order, also known as the Silent Brotherhood, was founded in 1983. However, the founder of the organization, Robert J. Matthews, was involved in the white supremacist movement for a number of years prior to the founding of this organization, and that's actually what we're going to look at during this episode. We're going to look at these other organizations and see how they acted as feeder groups for these other lesser-known offshoots that committed a number of heinous crimes during the 1980s and into the 90s. Now, these groups that we're going to be talking about during this episode, I have mentioned in other episodes covering white supremacist movements in the United States. They mostly have a very similar ideology, which is the Christian Identity Movement, which, if you'll recall from other series we have done, are a set of beliefs that has it that the Aryan race are the chosen ones destined to rule the world, and are also the actual Israelites depicted in the Bible. They also believe that Jesus Christ and his followers were of the Aryan race. One of the big selling points to people within this movement is a term known as ZOG, which is a Zionist occupied government. What does that mean? Basically, they believe that the American government is run secretly by Jews, specifically those who ascribe to the Zionist set of beliefs, which are basically a desire to have a Jewish homeland, as much land as possible, as many Jews in it as possible, and as few Arabian Palestinians in this homeland as possible. It's actually a hot button topic in the world right now, as people see what is going on between the Israelis and the Palestinians, as the Zionists trying to do an ethnic cleansing I'm not gonna dive into that whole can of worms, except to say that one side is more wrong than the other in this, and the murder of innocent people on either side is a war crime that should be punished. Back to our narrative, members of these groups, the Aryan Nations and the National Front, while hating all other races, particularly have an issue with the Jewish religion, people of the Jewish faith. They are neo-Nazis more than they are the traditional American white supremacist. Although many members get their start in organizations such as the Ku Klux Klan. So now, before we get to Robert J. Matthews, the founder of the Order, aka the Silent Brotherhood, we're going to look at the two organizations he was most known to have been associated with prior to the creation of the Order. We're going to start with the National Alliance. And in order to dive into the National Alliance, we need to look at its founder, William Luther Pierce III, who, unlike many in the white supremacist movement, was a highly educated and extremely intelligent individual, which he used to his advantage to spread his ideology of hate, get money, gain followers, and really rein in the dregs of society. So William Luther Pierce III was born in Atlanta, Georgia on September 11th, 1933. The eldest son of William Luther Pierce II, an insurance salesman, and Marguerite Farrell, a journalist. Numerous sources state that growing up, Pierce learned that his great-grandfather was Thomas H. Watts, who was the governor of Alabama and the attorney general of the Confederate States of America, something that later on in life he is going to take a lot of pride in. Now, according to Pierce's son, his father's upbringing was fairly chaotic, as his father was an alcoholic and his mother was detached emotionally and mentally from the family, rarely, if ever, showing any of her children any type of warmth or affection. And it should be noted before we jump further in that Pierce's son, Kelvin, renounced his father's ideology and has spent a number of years trying to both heal from what he was raised in and also bring awareness to people about the dangers of his father's ideology and ideology similar to his father's beliefs. Growing up, it was said that Pierce was paid by his mother to seek out the alcohol that his father stashed around the house. This began in earnest after the family moved to North. We know that when Pierce was 9 years old, his father died in a car accident on January 30th, 1943. And that after this, his mother raised the boys solely on her own, moving often throughout the southern United States where job opportunities presented themselves, and that starting around the age of 10, Pierce began working various odd jobs to help support the family. Interestingly enough, this background is very similar to backgrounds of various serial killers that we have encountered along the course of the past 5 years, where they have a really troubled home life growing up and end up having to help support the family financially from a very young age. To me, it raises questions about whether or not these individuals who have gone through these types of hardship growing up have anything else in common, psychologically speaking. Now, eventually, the family settles in Montgomery, Alabama, where his mother ends up remarrying. This, in turn, leads to Pierce being sent to a military academy, the Allen Military Academy in Bryan, Texas, where he completes his last 2 years of high school, and according to records, did fairly well academically. And it may be at this point in time that Pierce begins his fascination with physics, as William Luther Pierce is going to end up becoming a physicist. Regarding this time in his life, Pierce is quoted as saying he had been, quote, sort of a nerdy kid without social skills, unable to interact with women, and a perpetual loner, unquote. Pierce spent a lot of his free time studying science fiction, as well as learning about electricity. Hardly the interests of someone who in later decades would be seen as the most dangerous white supremacist in the United States. Pierce ends up getting a full scholarship to Rice University, which is based in Houston, Texas. He graduates in 1955 with a bachelor's degree and ends up getting a job working at the Los Alamos National Laboratory briefly during that year before going to the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, California, where he is a graduate student. Now, in 1957, Pierce gets married to Patricia Jones, who's a mathematician, also attending the California Institute of Technology. They have twin sons, Kelvin and Eric, both born in 1960. After leaving the California Institute of Technology, Pierce transfers to the University of Colorado Boulder, where he earns both a master's degree as well as a doctorate in physics. This is in 1962, after which he gets a job teaching physics as an assistant professor at Oregon State University. It's interesting to note that at this point in time, Pierce has no known racist leanings. However, he is inundated while teaching at the University of Oregon by both the civil rights movement and the American counterculture. We do know that at some point during his tenure at Oregon State University, he hears a speech from the founder of the American Nazi Party, George Lincoln Rockwell. And for some reason, the things that Rockwell is saying to him resonate with Pierce, and he begins a correspondence with Rockwell in 1963. We also know that he ends up joining the John Birch Society, which is an American right-wing political advocacy group that was founded in 1958 as an anti-communist organization. Although Pierce would later leave the John Birch Society as he thought their views on racial matters were much too lenient. Now, also during this time, students as well as colleagues noted that Pierce, who was considered a loner, was becoming fixated on Adolf Hitler, Nazism, and was said to have read Mein Kampf in its original Germanic form. Something that doesn't seem to have raised any alarm bells with anyone of note, most likely due to the fact that during this point in time, a lot of institutions as well as the federal government are focusing a lot of their attention on far leftist groups that are beginning to sprout up around college campuses across the United States. We do know that organizations such as the FBI, headed by J. Edgar Hoover, during this point, really didn't see the far right as anything that really needed to be worried about, as Hoover and his men were more concerned with the goings-on of the leftist movements, viewing them as an enemy of the United States. As many of these organizations claimed communism or socialism as the basis for their beliefs. Pierce would later say that early on in his tenure at Oregon State University, he had been fairly sympathetic to the civil rights movement, but as he saw more and more integration, it began to unsettle him, particularly when you would take into account the fact that he had grown up in the South, particularly in Georgia and Alabama. He was almost certainly introduced to a lot of the ideology that Klansmen claim to follow. Just in the course of his daily life. When Pierce was growing up in the South, this was the time of Jim Crow laws, segregation, etc. So it's easy to see why, even though he's college educated, as the 1960s progress and he sees more integration and change in society, while he is highly educated and initially sympathetic to, you know, the cause of the civil rights movement, there's that part of him that grew up in and around this old way of thinking, and this old way of thinking rejects the integration and what it sees as a threat to the way of life that he has always known. And that's not to excuse anything that William Luther Pierce said and or did in the coming years. It's only a view into his psyche and trying to understand how this individual with an obviously very high IQ could be leading such a mundane life and suddenly veer off so sharply from the beaten path, which is what's going to end up happening over the course of the next decade. As Pierce slowly becomes more and more radicalized, Pierce would later state that a big part of this was due to the fact that he saw a lot of interracial marrying going on among his colleagues at OSU, and this quote-unquote disgusted him. In 1965, Pierce is offered a job working for Pratt and Whitney, which is a aerospace manufacturing company headquartered in East Hartford, Connecticut, which is where Pierce would move his family to as he began work as a senior researcher. with a salary of $15,400 a year, which in 1965 was really good money. It's known that he had a government security clearance, although none of the projects that Pierce worked on during this point in time are said to have been of a secretive nature, although he did do some research for the United States government. Most researchers state that during his time working for Pratt & Whitney, Pierce spent a lot of his free time researching both history and racial matters, often at the Yale University. Now, I think a big part of what drew Pierce back to the East Coast is the fact that he was able to carry on a physical relationship with George Lincoln Rockwell as the American Nazi Party's headquarters was located in Arlington, Virginia. There is a story out there that during this point in time, Pierce attempted to drive a car through a picket line of protesters who were protesting at the Pratt & Whitney plant that he worked at. However, I could find no verification of this particular incident. It is known, however, that during the 1966-1967 time period, the federal government began investigating the American Nazi Party. And in doing so, they spoke with a number of Pierce's colleagues who stated that he was a first-class physicist who was an impenetrable personality. Many of them stated that they had an intense dislike of him as a human being. In May of 1966, Pierce takes a vacation from Pratt and Whitney. It's known that during this point in time, Pierce is dedicating an increasing amount of time to volunteering with Rockwell's American Nazi Party, writing literature for them free of charge. This is eventually going to lead Pierce to resign from this very well-paying job in order to devote himself full-time to helping Rockwell and the ANP grow and spread their message. The family ends up moving to Virginia, where Pierce's wife takes a job as a math professor at one of the local universities. It's been said that initially she supported her husband in his endeavors, however, she did not believe in his political ideology. To help contribute to the family's funding, Pierce begins to sell machine guns at gun shows and via mail order purchases. However, with the Gun Control Act of 1968, Pierce is forced to close this business. A lot of individuals who knew Pierce during this point in time stated that Pierce was almost certainly the most well-educated member of the American Nazi Party, but also the one with the most fervent ideology as far as violence being the key to achieving their aims. Basically, what that means is a lot of the American Nazi Party's membership were great at giving lip service to various ideas and vocalizing their support of the Nazi ideology. Pierce was heavily advocating for violent actions against the perceived enemies of their organization, namely Jewish people. It's, you know, a pretty startling and drastic turn of events for this man who had a once promising career to go from teaching physics to earning, you know, over almost $16,000 a year at a aeronautics company to pushing for violence against those different from himself. Pierce is also known to have pushed for a textbook definition of what the white race was, i.e. of Nordic stock. He didn't want anyone who was not of Nordic stock to be in any position of leadership or authority within the American Nazi Party. However, Rockwell and other high-ranking members of the ANP disagreed with this, wanting pretty much anybody who was white and provably white as a member of not only the American Nazi Party, but also in positions of leadership. This leads to a split among party members. However, Rockwell is eventually going to prevail. It's interesting to note that while Pierce was for violence against the enemies of the quote-unquote Aryan race, he never participated in any of the street actions that they undertook, instead preferring to advocate for it while he himself remained fairly well insulated, writing materials for the organization and helping to get them published. Pierce began funneling money into the various written undertakings of the ANP, particularly a quarterly journal that they published called the National Socialist World. Splitting the production costs of this publication with Rockwell, something that I am almost certain Pierce's wife was not happy about. Something else Pierce did for Rockwell was advise him on media relations as well as on how to best present the organization, which Pierce was not actually a member of, to the public. This led to a number of white power marches through Chicago during 1966. In 1967, the American Nazi Party ends up changing its name to the National Socialist White People's Party. If you've ever seen the Blues Brothers, you know that name and will recall the Illinois Nazis getting forced to jump in a lit river before dying when their car falls off a bridge and goes through a street in Chicago. In any event, while the name changed, the bullshit coming out of it remained the same. That is, until August of 1967. Now, leading up to August of 67, Rockwell had been having a series of conflicts with a cartoonist who worked for the organization by the name of John Patler, born John Christ Patsalos. Now, Patler had been harangued by various members of the party because he was an ethnic Greek and they did not believe that he was an actually white and should therefore be allowed in the organization. However, Rockwell disagreed with them and led to the change in definition of, you know, what the master race or white race was. In any event, as 1967 progressed, Patler and Rockwell began having more frequent clashes verbally, as Pattler felt that Rockwell was financially irresponsible. Some have speculated that Pattler may have been romantically interested in Rockwell, as numerous letters from him, as well as his fierce devotion to Rockwell, appear to be of a romantic nature. Many said that Pattler, you know, worshipped Rockwell and would leave the party and apologize profusely only and return before leaving again, eventually feeling isolated and questioning his affiliation with the group. Pattler leaves where Rockwell has him stationed in Spotsylvania, Virginia, and moves back to Arlington. It's been said that when Pattler left Spotsylvania, Rockwell had all of the locks on his doors changed, and all of Pattler's possessions moved to Arlington. Then Rockwell sends a letter to Pattler that basically throws him out of the Nazi party, only for Pattler to rail against the Nazi party and then beg for forgiveness. He said it to Rockwell in the last letter that he sent to him, that he, Rockwell, was a father figure, and that Pattler was basically Rockwell's son. Apparently, Rockwell disavowed Pattler. This leads to the events of August 25th, 1967, when Rockwell drives to a laundromat in Arlington, Virginia, goes inside, tells the clerk that he has forgotten something in his car, walks back out to the car, and is fired upon. Two shots are fired. One hits Rockwell in the chest, and he crawls out of the car, collapses on the pavement, and dies there. Roughly half an hour after this, Pattler is arrested. Eventually, Pattler is going to go on trial and be convicted for the murder, with a number of different theories as to why he murdered Rockwell being given, although he is going to end up being released from prison eventually after he renounces his former life and basically says that he should have been marching with Martin Luther King, etc., instead of associating with the likes of the Nazis who spew nothing but hate. Anyways, tantamount to our story is what ends up happening after the murder of Rockwell. A number of individuals within the organization start to believe that Pierce and other individuals within the National Socialist White People's Party may in fact have been behind Rockwell's murder, with a number of individuals, including Rockwell's mistress slash secretary, as well as his bodyguard, publicly stating that they believe that there was a conspiracy among Pierce, Matthias Cole Jr., who succeeded Rockwell as the head of the organization, and an individual by the name of Robert Allison Lloyd, and that they conspired to do this, sensing that Pattler was at a breaking point, and that if they could get him to tip over the edge, he would then murder Rockwell and allow them to take control of the party, although this was never verified by law enforcement, nor were any charges brought against any of these three individuals. So following this, Pierce sets about trying to organize college students to promote what he called total revolution. One of these individuals that Pierce recruits is a man by the name of James Mason, who Pierce recruited while he was a teenager, and Mason would later credit Pierce with saving not only his own life, but the lives of countless others when he convinces Mason to move to the National Socialist White People Party's headquarters, as opposed to carrying out his plan to murder school administrators. Should be noted, however, that Mason is, as of the recording of this episode, an avowed white supremacist. It's known, too, that during this point in time, Pierce began overseeing various phone lines where people interested in the ideology that the organization was espousing or wanting to participate would hear recorded messages, oftentimes written and recorded by Pierce, where he advocated for the murder of African Americans, Jews, U.S. senators, and various other people. In 1969, Pierce, along with another teenage accomplice named Joseph Tomasi, started the National Socialist Liberation Front, which was kind of like a youth movement within the NSWPP. Around this time, the federal government began paying closer attention to individuals in the right-wing white supremacist movements, particularly to Pierce, who they saw as a competent organizer and agitator. After he gives a speech at the University of Scranton in 1970, declaring that Richard Nixon should be dragged from his office and shot, the FBI launches a full-scale investigation of Pierce, although it does not appear that anything really comes from this incident, as at this time, violent rhetoric is not illegal in the United States. It's considered a protected speech. It is known that Pierce starts to flutter around to different white supremacist organizations during this point in time, acting as an organizer, a speaker, and something of a mentor to a number of these fledgling groups. One of the reasons that he did this was, as Pierce later stated in an interview, he felt that the National Socialist White People's Party's flagrant use of Nazi regalia and imagery was massively distasteful and would turn off the average white American to the group's message. He wanted to repackage this as a more all-American type of Nazism that would be more palatable to the working white middle class and youth of America, whom Pierce began to increasingly set his sights on. Now, Pierce ends up having a bit of a power struggle with the leadership of the party, wanting to share power amongst himself, Cole, and Lloyd, something that Cole is not interested in, and eventually Pierce is going to leave the National Socialist White People's Party at some point in July of 1970. Upon leaving the organization, Pierce writes a letter basically bashing Cole, calling him a pretend leader, and saying that the organization was going to devolve into nothing but a quote-unquote Matt Cole Nazi Fan Club. And after leaving the party, Pierce becomes an advisor to the National Youth Alliance, helping to create an organization in support of former Alabama Governor George Wallace in his bid for presidency. Eventually, Pierce is going to have a fight with the head of the National Youth Alliance, Willis Allison Carto. Pierce ends up winning this argument and gaining complete control of the National Youth Alliance. And Pierce keeps recruiting and putting out literature, and eventually in 1974, William Luther Pierce is going to rename the organization as the National Alliance, which was headquartered in Arlington, Virginia. And the National Alliance very quickly starts pulling in people from the other neo-Nazi organizations, as Pierce's very volatile and pro-violence rhetoric resonates with an increasing number of disenfranchised white youth looking for some place to belong. Those who came in readily accepted Pierce's idea that the National Alliance was going to spearhead an overthrowing of the United States federal government by white nationalists. Now, the National Alliance almost instantly starts putting out a periodical, originally known as Attack, where Pierce and other members of the organization can espouse their views and beliefs to those willing to pay for membership and receive this magazine, which is eventually going to be renamed the National Vanguard. Inside of this magazine, Pierce starts churning out a serialized fictitious story written under the pseudonym Andrew McDonald. And this serialized story is going to become so popular that Pierce is going to self-publish it in a book in 1978 called The Turner Diaries. Now, if you have listened to this show for any considerable length of time, particularly episodes involving white supremacists, you have heard of this book, The Turner Diaries, which basically depicts a dystopian future slash race war written as a series of diary entries from the perspective of Earl Turner from the period of September 16th, 1981 through November 9th, 1983, although this is eventually going to be updated to the 1990s as the book goes through numerous reprintings and is eventually officially published. Basically, when it's officially published by a book publisher, a number of organizations like the New York Times Book Review shit all over it for what it is, a racist and anti-Semitic tome designed to incite racial violence. Pierce, in an edition of the National Vanguard that announced the publication of the book in 1978, proclaimed it a blueprint for victory. I'm calling it a worthless piece of trash that has no literary value save to incite violence against others. This book is a turning point for the National Alliance and for Pierce, as no other tome outside of Mein Kampf, to to the best of my knowledge, is going to have such a far-reaching impact within the white supremacist movement, not only nationally, but also internationally. Many of the crimes that involve white supremacy that we have covered on this show, including the Oklahoma City bombing, Joseph Paul Franklin, and the Midwest bank robbers, all drew inspiration from this book. As did the group that we are going to be covering later on in this series, the Order, as the organization that Earl Turner is a member of inside of this book is called the Order, and the founder of the Order that we're going to be talking about drew inspiration not only for the organization's crimes, but also its name from this novel. Throughout the early part of the 1980s and through the 90s, the National Alliance is going to continue to grow. We know that in 1982, Pierce ends up divorcing his wife and remarrying another woman, which is going to last until 1985. He also starts up a white power music label known as Resistance Records. If you've ever been to a concert of hard rock or heavy metal from the 1990s up until the early 2000s, you have encountered these idiots. As outside of shows, particularly at the end, you'll have people out there handing out CDs of music, and usually it's, you know, an unknown band trying to get people to listen to their demo, but not always. When I encountered these dumb fucks, it was in 2002. We had been to a Danzig concert in Norfolk, Virginia. As we were leaving, someone handed a buddy of mine a CD. Knew nothing about it till we got in the car, put it on, and started laughing at how absurd and idiotic the music contained therein was. This became something of a running joke between my naval pals and I, as it was so god-awful and so stunning to receive something like this outside of a concert, as most of us came from the Northeast and had never encountered this type of blatant idiocy before. And throughout the years, Pierce would attempt on various occasions to get the National Alliance a designation as an educational organization. However, every time he applied for this or appealed a decision, it was denied by the IRS. Pierce ends up moving the group's headquarters from Virginia to a 346-acre plot of land in Mill Point, West Virginia, which he pays $95,000 for in cash. And as he had in Virginia, Pierce sets up a compound where all of the group's various activities are done, but also training is undertaken. Numerous individuals live on the property in structures that they themselves build. It's almost like a less organized version of Elm City. The following year, Pierce creates the Comothesis Community Church, which is nothing more than a church for the Christian identity movement. Pierce ends up securing tax exemption status based upon the fact that the organization is now considered a religious movement. he's going to continue with his various endeavors, speaking on campuses and at rallies for the remainder of his life, oftentimes drawing a somewhat considerable fee. Pierce pretty much ends up becoming the face of the white nationalist movement within North America, cutting off any ties he had to his former life, including his two sons in the process. Now, as stated earlier, Pierce, and by extension the organization, is going to be the inspiration for a number of violent acts that happen throughout the United States over the next 3 decades. He is also going to become a symbol of white nationalism internationally, traveling abroad to give speeches at many white power movement gatherings throughout Europe. And Pierce seems to have been conflicted in his later years. At some times, he would praise the various acts of violence that were carried out in the name of the white supremacist movement. Others, he would condemn them. Regardless, he was a fairly worthless piece of shit who created an organization that spread like wildfire and penned 2 novels that influenced untold amounts of violence against minorities around the world, for which he was never really held accountable. In the early 2000s, Pierce ends up being diagnosed with cancer and dying from kidney failure at the compound for the National Alliance in Hillsboro, West Virginia, on July 23rd, 2002, at the age of 68. The National Alliance, without Pierce to head it, is going to stumble on for another 11 years before finally dissolving in 2013. With most of its garbage message prior to that being distributed through online radio programs and its magazine known as the National Vanguard. Former members have attempted to revive the National Alliance in the years since, although, at least according to FBI data, this does not appear to have been anywhere near as successful as it once was under Pierce's leadership, where it was estimated that in 2003, just after Pierce's demise, there were almost 3,000 paying members of the organization. We are actually going to end the episode at this point. We'll be back next week where we will cover the second group that the leader and founder of the order, Robert J. Matthews, was involved with leading up to his founding of the order, aka the Silent Brotherhood. I hope that you guys have enjoyed this episode. As always, I look forward to any feedback from you. Until next time, stay morbid.